Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the Soundcheck Podcast.
There's one for you, 19 for me. 'Cause I'm the tax man. Yeah, I'm the tax man. 5%
of this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Yoko Ono didn't break up the Beatles. If any one person did, that person was Alan Klein. The Rolling Stones were ripped off for decades by Alan Klein. And when Sam Cooke died, his publishing rights suddenly materialized in the hands of, yes, Alan Klein. His sketchy business practices actually landed him in jail at one point, and that has been the book on Alan Klein. But now, Fred Goodman has written a new book about Alan Klein, and listen to this title. Alan Klein, the man who bailed out the Beatles, made the Stones, and transformed rock and roll. Fred Goodman, as they used to say on the I Love Lucy show, you have some splainin' to do.
And here I am.
Welcome back to Soundcheck.
Nice to be here, John.
So why write a book about a man who people either don't know at all or know as some kind of monster?
It's really interesting. I mean, if you grew up a Beatle or Rolling Stone fan, Alan Klein was a man you heard about from time to time, and you never heard anything good about him. You know, he was sort of the snake in the Garden of Eden, you know. And later on, you know, when I became a business reporter covering the music business, you know, I was a little bit intrigued about this guy from the standpoint that, like, well, he's starting to sound like a cartoon villain a little bit,
yes,
you know,
yeah.
And it's really sort of the fans, you know, they love their artists and they hate anybody who gets in the way, and the artists are unhappy with this guy, so he must be terrible.
Mm-hmm.
What happened was Alan Klein died in 2009, mm-hmm. and his son came to me a few years later and he said, look, you know, I've read your books. You know, when my dad died, a lot was written about him. Some of it was true. Some of it was not true. You know, he said, if it interests you, you know, I'll open up Abco's files to you, which is the company that Alan started. You know, we'll turn over personal papers, passports. You can see where he traveled, what he did. You know, whatever you want, we'll try and find for you. And there's no editorial control,
mm-hmm.
no
mm-hmm.
quid pro quo. I'm not looking for any particular verdict. I just want somebody who has some sort of sense of what the business is really about to kind of take a look at it and decide.
And for you as a writer on the business of music, that's important because a lot of this book is getting into like the nooks and crannies of how contracts work. And this was the genius of Alan
well,
Klein.
Well, Alan Klein, it was a genius. And for me as a reporter, I mean, somebody says to you, would you like to go through the correspondence and contracts of the Beatles and the Rolling Stones? You know, kind of figure out what they said when the door was closed. You know, this is the school nobody goes to. How do you say no?
Right.
So I thought, well, I got to do this. But yes, you know, Klein was by training an accountant and by practice a salesman.
Right.
You know.
And his training comes like on the streets of New Jersey.
Yeah.
And he's, you know, with like a newspaper, a local regional newspaper distribution service.
That's right.
Where he cottons on to the small, petty little tricks.
Well, he gets an early education in how the world works.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, he was a kid who actually spent a couple of years living in an orphanage because, you know, his mom died when he was an infant and his dad couldn't take care of all the kids. And he spent 6 years in an orphanage in Newark. And then by the time he was in high school, you know, he was helping to support the family. He was working in a newspaper distribution company in Newark. And in this, he starts to see how business operates because they're doing things like, you know, false billing. You know, if the bill is supposed to be $26.37, it's $32.67, and they don't fix it unless somebody says that's the wrong bill. You know, that kind of
right.
stuff, things falling off trucks. You know, he sort of cottons to how this stuff happens. And later on, when he goes to school to become an accountant, well, he remembers all this. And when he begins to audit record companies, he refuses to accept any of the figures a record company will give him. He wants to see their raw good orders. He wants to know how many hours the pressing plant went, you know, all that kind of stuff. He didn't come in to, you know, to go over the books. He'd come in to rewrite them.
Right. And this enables him to be seen in his mind and in the mind of some of his clients as a knight in shining armor riding in to save the underpaid artists.
Well, I mean, there certainly was a lot of that. You know, I mean, the artists were paid terribly. And in fact, when he goes in and starts to look at it and do his first audits, he realizes it's even worse.
Right.
Because it's not just that the accounting is off, but the contracts are skewed in such a way that the artists are never going to make money.
So, you know, early on in his career, he hooks up with Sam Cooke.
Mm-hmm.
Darling, you send me, I know you send me, darling, you.
This is, you know, probably what, very beginning of the 60s.
This is about 62, yeah.
And finds that, as you just said, there's all kinds of stuff in his contract that's...
Well, it's interesting. I mean, he was looking at the film business and seeing how, you know, some of the Burt Lancaster was sort of the leader in this. He had a company called Hechtel Lancaster, which was a production company, where they kept ownership.
Mm-hmm.
And he did the same thing with Sam Cooke. He turned around and he said, you know, what does Sam Cooke need RCA to tell him how to make a record? You know, you make the record, you deliver it to RCA, let's not give them so much. And in fact, he really revolutionizes. It's the first time, really, that artists are starting to do this. And it's interesting, in fact, that RCA is willing to do it.
Mm.
Because up until then, the record companies owned the records in perpetuity.
Right. They own everything lock, stock, and barrel.
Anything they could get.
So when Sam Cooke writes Change Is Gonna Come, this kind of transformative moment in his career and in pop music, mm-hmm. in the 60s, it's the production company that owns the song, not the record company.
Well, Sam was clever. I mean, Sam knew about publishing and things like that. But it's Klein's thing to set up this company called Tracy, which is essentially a record company that's going to give the records to RCA for distribution, and they're going to pay us to make the records. But at the end of our contract, the records come back to Sam.
Mm-hmm.
Now, because he's Alan Klein, the records don't come back to Sam. What happened was he originally set it up, the company up, as a holding company for tax reasons, because if he's saying, well, you know, if you take the money now, you'll have to pay taxes now. But if the money's paid into a holding company, you only pay taxes as you take it out. So it's put in as a holding company, and Alan is the president of it. And there were other people who were like J.W. Alexander, who'd worked with Sam for many years, were all officers of the company. But then, of course, something happens that no one really foresees, which is Sam Cooke dies. And what happens? Sam Cooke dies and Alan Klein owns everything. Now, if Sam Cooke lived, I'm sure things wouldn't have gone on like this in perpetuity. But it's pretty clear when you talk to people who worked with Alan that Alan knew exactly what he was doing.
Yeah.
It's no accident that he's owning the company.
Although we hope it was an accident that he lucked into this.
Well, the situation, yes. But, you know, there's a wonderful thing. He worked with a business manager in England named Lawrence Myers, who said to me that, you know, Alan's great lesson to him was, don't take 15% of an artist's money. Give them 85% of yours. In other words, own the assets.
Right. Which, in the case of Sam Cooke, included this classic song.
I don't know what's up there. Beyond the sky, it's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will. I go to the movie and I go downtown. Somebody keep telling me don't hang around. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes it will.
Sam Cooke and his classic Change Is Gonna Come. Alan Klein, at this point, was his, I guess, business manager. That's... Fred, you say in the book that he claimed to have coined that term.
Yeah, he claimed a lot of things. I mean...
Well, what do you think?
I doubt it.
Okay. You also write in the book that Alan Klein was not really, you know, he wasn't interested in nurturing emerging talent.
Yeah.
He wanted people who already had proven that they had the goods.
Right. He saw a way that he could get fair value for established talent. Mm-hmm. He didn't really have, he wasn't like, you know, Brian Epstein was a great impresario. I mean, we owe so much to Brian Epstein, you know.
The fifth Beatle.
Right. Well, this, not Murray the K. This thing that, you know, flows and flows and flows once the Beatles happened, you know. I mean, Alan Klein never could have done that, but, you know, he could recognize the value in the marketplace for an established artist and get him that. He could not make an artist. Although, interestingly, you know, Donovan gave him a lot of credit, you know, for really improving his career. I mean, he came to Alan Klein, you know, and Alan put him with another of his clients, the producer Mickey Most. You know, and once he gets with Mickey Most, Mickey Most gets him an arranger, and, you know, Sunshine Superman is the first record, and off we go.
Sunshine came softly through my window today. Could have tripped out GC, but I've changed my way. It'll take time, I know it, but in a while you're gonna be mine, I know it. We'll do it in style, cause I made my mind up, you're going to be mine. I'll tell you right now, in a trick in a book, and I'll be there, all that I can find. Superman or Green Lantern ain't got nothing on me. I can make like a turtle and dive.
So Alan Klein spots talent in Donovan. Earlier, Bobby Vinton, The Kinks. Mm-hmm. Ray Davies is like horrified
but
super
delighted.
Pleased with his negotiating tactics. And he's chasing the Beatles the whole time. That's his, as you describe it, his great white whale.
Yeah.
But he gets the Stones first.
Well, it's really fascinating. You know, the key signing, really, I think, after Sam Cooke is Mickey Most. Because what had happened was, you know, Alan had gone to England trying to land the Beatles. He gets nowhere with them. He knows who Mickey Most is. He's already done something for the Animals, who Mickey produced. Mm-hmm. And he goes to him and he says to him something so outrageous. He says to them, I can get you $1 million. Now, it's 1963,
right.
And $100,000 is a fortune.
Right.
Right. And he says, I'll get you $1 million. And, you know, Mickey and his business manager are laughing, sure, get us $1 million. And the deal is, not only will I get you $1 million, you won't have to pay me anything. Just make me your American business manager. I'll get paid by the record companies. And he goes back, and he knows how much value is in these contracts for Herman's Hermits, for the Animals, you know, and he goes and he renegotiates the publishing and the record, but he separates the deals.
Separates the American deal out.
Yes, because
very,
you know,
important.
People don't realize it's a standard thing. Where you sign, you get a certain royalty, and then you get half in the rest of the world. It's sort of the standard arrangement. And Klein, with these establishers, would immediately sever the contract and say, okay, we're going to do one deal in England, one deal in America.
So he does that for the Stones, who are itching to break into the American market.
Well, it's easy to forget that the Stones were, like, not at the front of the British invasion pack at that point. And Klein gets in just as they are getting there, which is satisfaction. Just as satisfaction comes, Klein is involved. He renegotiates their deal with Decca, which they had never made any significant money. He got them $2.5 million guaranteed.
Again, this is in the mid-60s.
Huge funds. I mean, you know, the Beatles are splitting a pence four ways.
Yeah.
You know, a farthing, you know, on a single. And it's like, who is this guy? And by the way, the perspective later on when the Stones are unhappy is, you know, this guy did us. But I spoke to Marion Faithfull, who was also in those deals, mm-hmm. and was managed by Andrew Lou Goldham and was signed similar to Decca. She said the first thing that happened was my royalty went from 2% to 12%.
Right.
She says, now that's still not great, but, you know, it was much better.
So, you know, at one point, sort of early in the book, as you describe Alan Klein sort of beating down the inner sanctums of these record companies and renegotiating these onerous, unfair contracts, I'm thinking to myself, so he is kind of like a Robin Hood. And then later in the book, he actually refers to himself as Robin Hood, stealing from the rich, giving to the poor.
Well, maybe.
Yeah, sometimes. So he makes the Stones wealthy.
Yes.
To the point that the Beatles take notice and are envious of how much money the Stones
are
making.
Well, there was a report that Paul McCartney kind of threw it up to Brian Epstein.
Yeah. And yet this same deal that makes them so much wealthier than their peers also comes back to haunt them for many, many years.
Right. You know, part of it is – and it gets kind of arcane. But you have to remember that back then in the pre-Thatcher England, taxes earned overseas by British citizens were onerous. I mean, if you were an English band making money in America, you were likely to lose 90% of your royalties in taxes, right? So the whole thing for someone like Alan Klein is – the client from England is saying, help me keep my money, right? So the Stones get $2.5 million, you know, and it's like, well, $1.5 million of it's coming from the United States. How are we going to, like, keep it instead of just getting, you know, $125,000? So he came up with some of these schemes that he learned over the years. They're all legitimate ways. And a lot of it has to do with investing the money and taking it in other ways, mm-hmm. right? So he does that, and the money is going to be paid out over 20 years. But what, of course, he doesn't tell the artists is that the money is going to earn much, much, much more than they're due, and he's not going to give them that.
Right.
Right?
So
I mean, he's giving them what their contract
is. He's got the lump sum. He's right. playing with that money and making money on the money.
Exactly.
But all he owes them is what's in the contract.
You know, the $2.5 million.
Right. Which is not small change
no.
back at that in those days. But so, you know, as the Stones begin to realize that this great upfront deal is not so great long term,
right.
and they try and extricate themselves, they suddenly find that this company, this ABCO company that Alan Klein has formed, actually owns them.
That's sort of the given story.
Yeah.
And the real story is a good deal more nuanced and complicated.
Yes,
without getting wild on
don't.
I mean, look, for example, he gave them their publishing deal. Right,
yeah.
He became their publisher.
Right.
And the publishing deal that Alan and ABCO gave them was a very, very good deal.
Right.
It's far better than the one the Beatles had from Dick James.
But they find when they're doing Exile on Main Street that Alan still owns the publishing on some of those songs.
Well, that's because they composed them during the period they were signed to that publishing deal. ABCO can prove they were composed during that period. So it's a pretty straightforward thing. It's talking about four or five things. But, you know, Alan's a very interesting guy. I mean, I don't even get into it into the book, but he's doing things like, you know, he got into a lawsuit with the Robert Johnson estate over Love in Vain.
Huh.
Right. And one of the other tracks, you know, that's on Exile on Main Street,
right.
because, you know, he liked the tunes. He wanted to own them, you know, and he didn't mind. He was a litigious guy. He liked to go to court. He didn't mind as long as he thought it was worthwhile. He'd spend the money.
He liked the action.
He did like the action.
So this song, All Down the Line, this is one of four or five on Exile that turned out to be
composed during the term of the contract.
From the Rolling Stones' Exile on Main Street, that's All Down the Line, album that comes out after they've broken with their manager, Alan Klein. But as it turns out, he's still got his hooks in them. We're speaking with Fred Goodman. He's the author of the brand new book called Alan Klein, The Man Who Bailed Out the Beatles, Made the Stones, and Transformed Rock and Roll. So let's back up a minute, because now we're into the 70s. But in 1966, Alan Klein is on top of the world. He is the manager of the Beatles and the Rolling Stones.
Well, it's a little bit later when he gets the Beatles, but yes, there is a period, it's around 69, when he's managing both the Beatles and the Rolling Stones, and it's incredible. I mean, there's no one like that today, you know. You couldn't envision it, you know. And he can't even handle it. You know, the fact is he really only has eyes for the Beatles.
Right. So the Stones now are beginning to feel like second fiddlers. They don't like it.
They don't like it. They also are going on tour in America. You know, they haven't been in the States in a couple of years. They're going to, you know, launch a big tour. And that's Alan's job, is to oversee America. Meanwhile, he's trying to take apart Apple, you know, and save the Beatles, who had serious financial problems.
Right. So Brian Epstein has died, and they've been sort of stuck in this morass, both legal and financial, trying to figure out who owns what and where the money is.
And who's going to manage our finances for us. You know, I mean, eventually Paul McCartney suggests, you know, his father-in-law and his brother-in-law, you know, the Eastmans, you know, who certainly, you know, have a pedigree to come in and do this. And John Lennon, you know, gets Alan Klein, you know, and they really kind of bond, these guys.
Yeah.
It's a fascinating thing, you know. I mean, Alan was nothing if not able to study his quarry, you know. And he had years to watch John Lennon and figure out what he was going to say to John Lennon and how he was going to approach this. And it was really, really, really important to Alan to have the Beatles, you know. Alan, as I said, you know, grew up in an orphanage. I mean, John Lennon, you know, was a guy with a world-class chip on his shoulder, you know. And I think in Alan, he saw a kindred soul, you know, another guy who was cut from a regular cloth, who everybody hated because he wasn't supposed to succeed.
Right.
You know, and they just kind of, you know, bonded.
Yeah. And it was, I think you say he's like the one sort of client with whom he got really kind of personally involved.
Yeah, he really, it meant a lot. He fell in love with Lennon. I mean, there's no doubt about it. I mean, John Lennon's approval meant everything to him.
Paul McCartney, on the other hand,
wanted nothing to do with him.
Yeah.
Just detested Klein. I called him a cheap New York crook, you know. look, it's kind of amazing when you look at it. I mean, Paul McCartney literally goes to court to break up the Beatles to not have Alan Klein running his business.
Right. So Alan becomes John and Yoko's manager. Then he gets George and Ringo
They always, you know, look, there is a sense in the schism. You know, Alan thought he really knew what was going on, and I guess he did, but I don't think he really understood how deep the rift was between Lennon and McCartney at that point. And interestingly, I mean, when you read the court documents, it's very clear Harrison and Starr, they're willing to follow Lennon. They would rather go with Lennon than McCartney in terms of where the band is going, for a lot of personal and musical reasons. Mm-hmm. And it's just, this is what feels better to them. So, and they like Alan, you know. I mean, Ringo makes some statements that, hey, John Eastman, he's a kid, you know, this kind of thing. Who is he to manage the Beatles? You know, that kind of thing. Alan, oh, he's a heavyweight, you know. And he likes him. I mean, they get along. And it continues. Alan is key in the concert for Bangladesh. You know, he's making movies with Ringo. Alan produced spaghetti westerns, and Ringo was in one of them, you know, that kind of thing.
And you know, this is at a point where the band is recording Abbey Road,
which
is a big card for Alan Klein to play.
Well, they have Abbey Road, and, you know, not only because he needs to renegotiate the American contracts, you know. And when you look at those contracts, they're kind of fascinating. There's all sorts of weird things in them, like whether or not the solo albums are going to count against Beatle albums. And if they don't count, you have to pay three times as much in royalties. I mean, it's a wild thing that he did. But the upshot of it is that he also is the person who plucks Let It Be out of the air, for good or for bad.
Also, before he even does that, he helps to determine the singles from Abbey Road.
Well, that's very interesting. You know, let me
play the first single, because this is the one that kind of hit the top of the charts here in the States, from the Beatles' Abbey Road.
Me.
Come Together from the Beatles, from Abbey Road, is
the first
single, but the second single is in fact the B-side of
Right, Something.
Something.
Which is interesting because I didn't realize until I was researching this book that it was the habit of the Beatles to split the singles A and B between Lennon and McCartney.
Right. Something.
Something is George Harrison.
Yeah.
Paul McCartney, you don't like me? Okay. So Something is put on. And of course, there's some question later on Let It Be. You know, what role did Alan have in picking The Long and Winding Road as a single, which is, I think, the last Beatles single.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, it was a tune that McCartney had disowned because of the Phil Spector arrangement.
Right.
And felt that it was something nefarious that Spector and Klein had done against him.
The long and winding road. Disappear. I've seen that road before. It always leads me here. Lead me to your door.
So we have, in the fullness of time, decades later, the Let It Be
Naked.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The Paul McCartney version that isn't Phil Spectorized.
Right. Also has its downsides.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So as the Stones did before them, the Beatles eventually part company with Alan Klein.
Right.
Why?
Because he couldn't settle with McCartney. What happened was McCartney went and filed this suit in England and won.
Is this the legal action where Alan Klein kind of shoots himself in the foot?
He
by...
does, yeah. It's a little involved, but the gist of it is that... he spends a tremendous amount of time defending his honor in court rather than just saying, you know, there's no basis in English law to throw me out.
Right.
Which is really what they should have done,
right,
over and beaten the judge over the head with that. But, you know, they really figured Alan out. I mean, it's John Eastman's great moment. You know, he's a young 26-year-old lawyer. His father, who is a veteran music business guy and the lawyer for de Kooning and other painters, you know, he's a real established guy, says, you're nuts. Don't take on this guy. He'll kill you, you know. But he goes out and does it and wins.
Yeah.
You know, the upshot of it is the court appoints a receiver and the Beatles' money is being handled by this receiver. And it's up to the Beatles to work out how they're going to finally solve things and get their money. And, you know, and millions of dollars are building up. But Alan, he can't admit that he's lost. He's always thinking there's going to be a way I'm going to get around this. I'm going to have another shot. I'm going to do this. And finally, after 2-3 years of this, you know, Harrison and Lennon and Starr are like, look, we just... Alan's yeah. never going to settle. It's not anything. It's not a question of, like, he robbed them. I mean, in fact, he did really good things for the Beatles. Paul McCartney didn't like him, didn't trust him. Paul McCartney's entitled to try and figure out how he's going to get who he does trust to run his business. But the upshot is there's nothing that I can see here that would justify that.
The wild and windy.
This is not the only time that Alan Klein loses. A small, kind of almost insignificant snubbing of an IRS agent in his office years
yeah.
earlier comes back to bite him in the butt big time.
But good. Well, it's that comes up in the English case because, you know, he had not done proper paperwork on taxes. He had paid a payroll tax. He had not filed the proper paperwork. He didn't want to talk to the IRS guy. He made him wait, and then he sloughed him off. And, you know, he just didn't do it. You know, he was being a jerk. And ultimately, he lost a court ruling that said you didn't file this thing. And this was one of the things that was shown in the Beatle case. Look, he's got a tax judgment against him in the States. How can Paul McCartney trust him? You know, that kind of thing. Later on, he gets into more trouble with the Justice Department, which is there is an investigation into the selling of promotional records. And that produces a tax case that he also loses. Mm-hmm. And Alan wound up going to jail for 2 months on conviction of a misdemeanor for not filing tax work that had to do with, you know, did he sell promotional records?
Right. Which, by law, they're promotional.
They're promotional. They're not for sale.
Right.
Yeah.
So as the 80s dawn, here's the man who's been dumped by the Beatles. He's been dumped by the Stones. He's done time in jail. He would appear at this point to be the most toxic man in the music business. But there is one other card and one other fight for Alan Klein, and it's a fight that he wins, and it brings us back to that now decades-old agreement with the Rolling Stones.
Right.
And that is the hit song by The Verve.
Right, Bittersweet Symphony.
Bittersweet Symphony. For folks who maybe can't place it right off the name, you know, just from the name alone, this is the song. That's Bittersweet Symphony, big hit for The Verve, been used in countless commercials and movies.
Broadcasts, yeah.
Fred Goodman, I grew up on the Rolling Stones. I would expect that I could pick out a sample of a Stones tune anywhere. Nothing in this song, when I first heard it, spoke to me of the Rolling Stones.
This is copyright in the music business in all of its craziness right here. I mean, this is what Steve Albini is talking about. What happens is Alan is the publisher for the Rolling Stones through ABCO. Bittersweet Symphony, that riff, is taken from a record by the Andrew Luge Oldham Orchestra of an arrangement of The Last Time. Now, it doesn't sound like the Rolling Stones song.
Right.
Doesn't sound like the Rolling Stones The Last Time. And it's actually a riff that was written by a composer who was paid a flat rate and never got compositional credit for it. Okay, so he's out of the picture.
Mm-hmm.
But Mick Jagger and Keith Richards still have the copyright on that Andrew Luge Oldham recording. When the Verve made Bittersweet Symphony, they made a mistake. They went to Decca. They cleared the recording rights to use the Andrew Luge Oldham Orchestra sample. They did not clear the rights, which you have to do, for the underlying composition with the publisher. After the fact, the record is made.
Mm.
Uh-oh. They call up ABCO. They get Alan's associate, who says to them, oh, no, we don't believe in sampling. We're not going to license it to you. Yeah, they tried to lowball us. We told them to get out of here. You know, we're not going to do it. We don't believe in it. Well, Ken Berry, who is the president of EMI, comes to New York, plays Urban Hymns, the album, and says, this is our big release on Virgin for the year. It's going to be a multi-million seller. Alan, you got to give us the publishing right. You got to clear it. And Alan goes, you know, I just don't believe in sampling. No. Well, he lets 2 days go by, and then he calls up Ken Berry, and he says, you know, I see you're in a spot. Here's the deal. We're going to buy Richard Ashcroft's rights to the songs, and we'll own all the publishing.
Richard Ashcroft is
the guy from The Verve,
the frontman of The Verve,
right? Along with, so the songwriting credit for Bittersweet Symphony is Jagger, Richards, Ashcroft.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we will buy Richard Ashcroft out for $1,000. Okay, and that was what they had to do to get the record released. I mean, it was brutal.
Yeah.
Just brutal.
And yet, a big, unexpected late payday for Jagger and Richards
yep.
from the guy they hated. And
they got them
him.
A Grammy nomination for Song of the Year
yeah.
on a song they had nothing to do with, didn't sound like a song they wrote. And by the way, you know, the The Last Time by the Rolling Stones sounds like a song called This Could Be the Last Time, an old gospel song recorded by the Staple Singers in 1955.
And yeah.
As I joke in the book, you know, fortunately for the Rolling Stones, Alan Klein didn't represent the Staple Singers.
Is there an irony, though, that a guy who prided himself on doing right by the artist so completely screwed the artist who created this song in order to get this
yeah,
deal?
That's the two-sided thing with Klein.
So, yeah. The guy who broke up the Beatles is the guy who bailed out the Beatles. The guy who ripped off the Stones is the guy who made the Stones in the first place.
Well, he certainly had a lot to do with. Look, let's be serious. I mean, two people made the Rolling Stones, and you know, their names are Keith Richards and Mick Jagger.
Yeah.
You know, but the fact of the matter is, you know, he was very instrumental in getting them over in America, and he did help them at a key point in their career.
The book is called Alan Klein, The Man Who Bailed Out the Beatles, Made the Stones, and Transformed Rock and Roll. Brand new from my guest, Fred Goodman. Fred, very nice to have you back with us on Soundcheck today.
Thank you, John. My pleasure.
Thanks for listening. Stay connected by subscribing to the Soundcheck podcast on iTunes. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook, and download the new WNYC mobile app for free. See you next time. I'm John Schaefer.
Please allow me to introduce myself. I'm a man of wealth and taste. I've been around for a long, long year. Stole many a man's soul and faith. I was around when Jesus Christ had his moment of doubt and pain. Made damn sure the pilot washed his hands and sealed his face.